Hey, good morning. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening, wherever you're at. Thank you, Rupert, for joining me on this discussion. Welcome to News of the Money World, everybody. How are you, Rupert? Good?
I'm very well. Nice to be into school holidays. Markets recovering. Life is good.
Yeah,
kind of back to normal.
The new normal. Never a shortage, though, of stuff just to be entertained by on the topic of markets. It's kind of what we do, right? There's lots of stuff.
No, it's an action-packed time, actually. Yeah. But, I mean, with school holidays, there wasn't my usual daily fix of an hour of Bloomberg surveillance, which has mean I've had a bit of catch-up to do and realize there are other things in life apart from financial markets. And to be honest, I'm not sure I like that other alternative view.
Well, we'll try and make it more interesting for your other side of your life anyway. Off the top of my head, anyway, I could think of a few things. But we have an FOMC meeting, I believe, today. Yeah. U.S.
morning,
time will
US
be tomorrow, or U.S. time today, our time tomorrow. We have a really interesting event that's unfolded over the last couple of days with Japanese currency. We have markets continuing to confound us, and we have the reality of the Fed pivot kind of sinking in terms of fading away, and the market still keeps on doing what it's doing. There's no real change really to the overall narrative that we still don't know how the heck markets work. And so it's completely fruitless trying to pick it. And so I thought I would just start off with a post of there's a fellow that I follow on X, formerly known as Twitter. I don't know how long we have to say that for, but there's a fellow that I follow on Twitter who puts out some interesting posts every now and then. His name is Rajat Soni. He's a certified financial advisor from the United States, presumably. This is what he says about the markets. Unpopular fact. This is going to make some people angry, he says. The S&P 500 is a pyramid scheme. You aren't buying companies you support. You buy stocks because you think they make the best returns. You don't even give your money to the company. You give it to other investors to buy their shares, and they spend it, not the company. These companies take on massive amounts of debt, make their executives richer, and take out more and more control over our lives. Do you believe, like there's a lot in that, but do you believe in general that the markets are a pyramid scheme?
So it is a really interesting question. Fundamentally, no, because at the end of the day, the markets are based on something, right? And the markets are based on cash flows. So the US, in the US, the S&P 500 is currently trading at a 20 times PE. We might all believe that that's very, very high. But there are underlying earnings, growth, cash flow, all of this kind of good stuff that supports it. So fundamentally, is it a pyramid scheme? No. However, does it have pyramid scheme characteristics? Yes. And when we talk about sentiment, we talk about FOMO investing, all of these things where you go, fuck, I'm going to miss out. I've got to get in as quick as I can. It's going up. Is it going up at the moment because the fundamentals necessarily drive it? Debatable. Probably actually no. It's driving up because the retail sentiment is going really, really high. And so not a pyramid scheme, but definitely something that is driven by sentiment more than anything. And a good example of this was something I was listening to this morning where we were talking about in the last week, right, we've had Tesla report to $500 billion market cap. We've had Microsoft report a $3 trillion market cap. We've had Google report a $2 trillion market cap. And who else? We had Meta, who was, I think they're about $1.5 trillion. Every single one of those results announcements has resulted in a move of over 10% on the day. 5 years ago, it was unheard of for these mega caps to move so much and be so volatile. And I think that probably demonstrates just how sentiment-driven the market is at the moment and also how uncertain. So is it a pyramid scheme? No. It's got underlying things that we are investing in, but does it trade on pure play fundamentals that we can model out?
Okay. No. So what you're basically saying is like with these recent valuations and the impact on the price in one day, 10% move in a day type thing, like that's kind of, that would be just a typical day in the life of a crypto investor, right? Like you kind of just, oh, yeah, so what's the big deal?
Yeah, I see where you're going here.
Yeah. And so we're kind of seeing though that like underneath all of this pyramid scheme type behavior, we do see that ultimately the market is valuing cash flows all the time. It's just a valuation machine all the time, valuing these cash flows. And yes, there's layers of sentiment built on top of that, and Ponzi scheme, or more accurately, pyramid scheme, follow the sheep, herd mentality, investing going on all over the show. But really underneath it all are still some fundamental drivers, right?
Oh, massive. And that's the honest truth. There are always fundamental drivers. There are always fundamental things that are going to be driving this. And even when you think about it, right? So currently S&P 500, forward looking PE 20 odd times. Historically, it's been down over the last 20 years, kind of 16 to 17 times. It's kind of ranged anywhere kind of in the medium term from like 12 to 25. So, yeah, that kind of means that it has always remained rooted in those cash flows. And I think that's an important point to remember, right? Do we have it flipping between 2 and 100? No. It's always just got to come back to the problem that we have at the moment and why we're all kind of so uncertain and so nervous is, for the last 4 years or since 2020, none of us have actually, or no one has been able to figure out what the heck is going on. So economically, every single set of economic forecasts that's been provided has been wrong. We've completely misunderstood where the consumer's at, where the consumer is spending, the size of the consumer balance sheets. And that's why, unfortunately, it is becoming more and more sentiment-driven and more Ponzi-like, because no one's really sure, right? We saw last week kind of, and as this US reporting season started, first up, Facebook, a big miss, a big just kind of with their revenue down, profit down. At the same time, they're also saying AI is going to cost us a hell of a lot more than we expected, plus it's going to take longer to pay off. We saw a massive drop on the day, and everyone goes, oh, this is a sign, this AI phobia, this AI kind of norm is disappearing. 2 days later, we see, and at the same time, we also had Jerome Powell come out warning us on interest rates. 2 days later, we have Microsoft come out. Microsoft had an absolute blockbuster set of results. AI has driven much higher growth than anyone had anticipated. And kind of we're starting to see how actually this humongous mega cap, one of the largest companies in the world, can continue to grow at 15, 20% per annum. Google, another strong set of results. Tesla, pretty shitty results, but they've been very well flagged. But again, because the stock is down 40% year to date, they kind of needed a bit of a recovery rally. But I think what we've seen through these results season is people are reacting so much on the day because they have no idea what to expect. And I think that's the big dichotomy that we're at. That's why the last 12 months, it's been really, really hard for investors, because all of the traditional signals of a recession, all the traditional signals of companies should be struggling in this higher interest rate environment, none of it's played out. And that's the hard part.
So it's misunderstood, or it's just broken traditional signals, do you think?
No, I think we've always run the risk of every time in history we say this is different, this is different, this is different, we get kind of punished a couple of years later when we find out, no, it was actually the same. I think there is no question that the period that we have been through over the last 4 or 5 years has been challenging, to say the least, and it's been kind of something that we've never seen before, right? 2020, we stopped the global economy. We absolutely stopped it. We then kind of restarted it with massive amounts of stimulus, and that's taken a while to follow through. We locked people in their houses for kind of 12, 24 months. We moan in New Zealand about our lockdowns and how Auckland's kind of suffered, but we got off so lightly compared to anywhere else in the world. And I think that's why these consumers have got big balance sheets. We've come out of that environment where we've kind of gone through a bit of a heart attack and then a restart. And then what we've seen in the US, we've seen a complete rewiring of the US economy and to a certain extent the global economy over the last kind of 12, 24 months as well, right? Started with Donald Trump with his tariffs on China. Post-COVID, we realized that actually kind of just-in-time supply chain management and caused a whole series of issues when shipping broke down. That's now been exacerbated by tensions in China. And so in the US, you've got this manufacturing sector, which is going through a massive resurgence all on the back of government spending, right? I mean, that's the sad thing about New Zealand stimulus versus American stimulus. With the American stimulus, it is humongous. But they're building chip factories. They're building renewable energy plants. They're building renewable cars. There's a whole world of manufacturing that's creating all of these jobs, all of these workers coming in. And I think that's the bit that we're operating in this environment where we've got so many different things happening at the same time that, yeah, our traditional models haven't been very good at understanding them. But and also going, so we're looking at the easy stuff, right? So we look at it and we go, higher interest rates, yep, that drives recession. How do you get inflation under control? That drives recession. Why do we believe that? Because that's what happened in the 70s. That's what happened in the 80s. And then every time in the past where we've gone higher interest rates, it's kind of driven a slowdown. But that's the easy top level picture. What we haven't been looking a bit at is kind of what's happening bubbling along underneath, right? Which is the onshoring of manufacturing, the strengths of the domestic consumer, all of those things. But does normality return? You have to say it will at some point. It's just a matter of when.
Well said. Yeah, well said. Like there's a lot of noise, a lot of signals. And what sometimes I can't figure out is why on balance, all of those signals don't bring the market down. And like you said it just a second ago, winding back right to the start, March 2020, lockdown people, and then force the cost of money down to zero and make it freely available. Of course, that's going to lead to inflation. And that was obvious for some at the time, but not to everyone, clearly not the central banks. And then now we're paying for it now. Like that part is exactly what you would have expected. Yet in other areas, it's not at all what you expect. Like, for example, geopolitical concerns right now. You look at all of these economies and all of these nation state issues that we have around the world, which is leading to probably more of a reason for those nation states to go to war. And funnily enough, that's the direction that we're all heading. So that part there kind of makes a lot of sense. But again, it doesn't make sense that this increasing talk that a Fed pivot isn't around the corner. That doesn't make sense that markets aren't responding to that by much lower and lower, rates of performance, because you'd think that they would factor in the future a little bit more, that, hey, if interest rates stay this high for this long, surely that's going to cause a lot more collateral damage.
Well, I think there's two parts to that, right? And I think this is also the second piece that we're kind of completely got our head around is the new market, right? So when we think about, those four companies that I just mentioned, right, that makes up about 15-20% of the S&P 500, the US stock market. I think the market has changed so much in the last 10 to 15 years. We're now dominated. We're back into the era of the monopolies, right? The oligopolies. Well, I'd probably actually argue even monopoly. That's oligopolies too generous to them. And if you think about a lot of these companies, right, they're at the forefront of technological change. And I think we can all agree AI, the big guys are going to benefit because the costs involved in AI are humongous. And so therefore, gone are the days where I can just build out a product suite and then clip the ticket and charging everyone $100 a month and have kind of zero marginal costs. AI changes that, right? You need big data sets, big processing power. Mm-hmm. So the big guys win. The other big part about the what's happening at the moment is there will always be winners and losers in inflation. And so if we think about it, Microsoft's, Google's, a lot of these big, steady businesses that make up the top 15-20 companies in these markets, they've all got pricing power. And so they're able to withstand kind of inflation's actually quite a good story for some of these companies, right? If you've got low debt, you've got a very strong market position and inelastic supply, demand, then actually what does that mean? Mm. You just put up your prices. All of a sudden they've gone from 2% pricing growth a year or even static pricing in the case of Microsoft to actually I can now put through 10% per annum and no one's going to blink. And at the end of the day, and Google's the same, right? I can put through 10% per annum and I can offer a few extra little services with AI. I can do a few extra bits and pieces here. And actually, that's where life gets really great for them, right? If I'm at Kraft Heinz in the US where I go the supermarket staples or Coca-Cola, where, again, I've got a such strong brand name that actually people are going to shop any point in time. Inflation, and I've got a very strong balance sheet. Inflation is really good for a lot of these companies, right? And I think that's also the bit that we probably haven't quite understood. And that's also why NASDAQ and kind of S&P trading at all-time highs, Russell 2000, nowhere near that strong, right? And they're kind of still, they're only up kind of 5, 10% from their lows. And so that's the dichotomy that we're seeing. We're seeing when we're talking about the markets, but actually when we're talking about the markets at the moment, we're talking kind of about 50 companies. Yeah. And that's it's a very different story. It's also why when we talk about Europe, they don't have these companies with pricing power. They don't have a lot of the strength of kind of listed companies that we're seeing, which is why the S&P alone has been on such a strong tier.
So consumer.
This is quite insightful.
Was that right?
For a change.
Yeah.
This is an insightful conversation.
So far you're doing all the talking. That's why. So.
We might edit that comment out there, Bill.
I'll leave it in there. Okay. The interesting piece about what you're saying there is that we have these non-durable consumables, right? That's what they are. They're non-durable consumable. They're things that we need provided by the companies that we invest a lot in, because if we have a fund, chances are there's probably going to be somewhere between 30 to 50% potentially that's invested in US markets, depending on what kind of managed fund you're investing in and what your profile is and all that sort of stuff. So we're actually putting a large share of our money into these companies, which really just is reinforcing this greater and greater, the big will become bigger thing. They have the scale so they can, like you say, they have the pricing power, but as they increase their prices, there's a gap between the increasing cost, which is really increasingly just becoming energy. And so now you're hearing stories of, I think it was Amazon that just recently invested in a nuclear power plant to operate one of their data centers. I could be wrong in terms of Amazon or one of the other companies, but you can see that what's happening here is that it's all coming down to one resource, which is electricity. That is powering not just this AI revolution, but the Bitcoin or the crypto revolution as well. It always comes down to power. And who knew that uranium would be such a good investment, right? In this new world. But going back to what you were saying, the, say, 50 companies that are predominantly all US, that's where we're going to get the majority of our returns, perhaps in this stagflation world, right? Because they have pricing power, they have a massive moat around them, great brand name, and increasingly we can't do life without these brands, or at least we think that's the case. And life would have to get pretty bad in terms of a stagflationary environment where we all lose our jobs before we cancel our services that we get from these Magnificent Seven companies, right?
Massive, right? And I'm just on my screen here looking at the list of the holdings in the top 20 companies in the US. And I mean, to be honest, the only one that makes me nervous is Home Depot, because that will kind of move up and down. But you kind of the rest of them, right? United Healthcare, right? People still need to spend money on healthcare. Visa, again, higher transaction costs are a massive win for them, right? When you're taking a clip of everything that's spent, inflation's a win. JP Morgan, we know that higher interest rates benefit the big banks. So, yeah, it's really interesting, right? I think all of these companies with very strong balance sheets. It's going to be really interesting to see how it goes. But it's a very different narrative that I think we probably just haven't quite looked at enough. And I think we say this a hell of a lot, but we've got to remember Wall Street does not reflect Main Street. And by that, what I mean is the companies that we buy and we invest in with our KiwiSaver or on the market often have very little in common with actually how we spend our money and how we are employed, right? We're employed in service businesses and in manufacturing. But actually, again, when I look down that list of kind of the top US companies, none of those exist in there. And those are the kind of companies that are going to be really, sorry, those will be the companies that are hit by recession. So I think that's the other part to kind of wrap up on kind of why it's also different to what we expect is we probably haven't quite recognized the change in that market. And to your point on Google, what I found fascinating last year, right, we do a bit of Google spend here at Kōrā. And one of the things that I remember one of our consultants saying to us, oh, yeah, we just think Google's put their prices up by 20%. What do you mean? Oh, well, kind of we're finding that the minimum bid prices are just higher and no one really knows why and no one really kind of can prove it, but we just suspect that's the case. That's not a bad business model when you can put your prices up by 20% and no one's even sure
you're done. Or why, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. But man, so it's interesting. So the market structure seems to be almost narrowing, and you have this super, super steep pyramid structure where we have tech at the top and everything else is squeezed at the bottom in terms of services, which is what we all get employed by. So there has to be a limit though at some stage, right? Like you say, there's mean reversion that eventually has to happen.
The mean reversion will come. It's just a matter of when, right? And I think that's the problem is that, the mean reversion will come. And so if we look at it over a 50-year horizon, Russell 2000 does outperform S&P 500 because generally smaller companies should do better and should kind of get there. The gazillion-dollar question on everyone's mind is just the when. When does this happen? And if we are heading to recession and we are heading to slightly more difficult economic times, then the pyramid at the moment, when I look at that pyramid and I look at the balance sheets on those companies, I look at their pricing power.
Yeah,
that's what you want.
That's why it doesn't really matter. And this is keep on going around in this circle with a few people that I'm talking to at the moment where it doesn't really matter what the market conditions are like right now. And it doesn't matter that it's going to be mean reverting at some stage and we're all going to get our butts kicked in some sort of event where everything crashes, right? Like, sure, over a 50-year time frame, we know that there's going to be at least one of those events, probably a few, that will happen between now and then. But if you're still scaling up, if you're just starting out with your investing journey, who cares if your $10,000 portfolio has gone down by 70%? I know that's a lot of money for some people, but in the big scheme of things, relative to that which you're trying to build, which is hopefully over $1 million or more, does it really matter if in the first 3 years you get a hiding? Probably not, as long as you get the asset allocation right for that half a century that you might be investing for, or in a lot of cases, probably closer to 30 years, right?
Oh, exactly. And that's the problem, right? And that's why I think we said this last week. That's why the passive investors have done so well over the last 18 months, because everyone sits there 2 years, everyone's been sitting there petrified and going, we've got to hold out, we've got to pull out, we've got to pull out. And effectively, the markets continue to surprise. And so, it is a tough one. What we do know is the people that try and time the market, the people that try and pick the ups and the downs, more often than not, they'll lose.
But at some stage, they might be right. You never know, right? Yeah, that's the thing.
Oh, look, everyone, all gamblers are right once or twice in their lifetime.
And I guess
there's no question, right? Everyone is right at some point. The problem is recognizing. Were you right because you are in the top 0.02% of investors?
Yeah. Or were you right almost, you got I think almost every time it's luck, right? Because we can't see into the future. And that's the problem. We have no way of actually testing this because we can't time travel. But at some stage, there'll be the people that are sitting on the sidelines will be right, but for reasons which we don't know yet. And even they won't know yet. They'll know in hindsight, and then they'll write a book on it. And then that'll form the fundamental layer of how we invest for the next generation, maybe. I don't know. But we are at a we are at a point in our world's history, I think, where there is transformational change happening, not just incremental change. And so that's why I think every idea that you hold tightly onto will be challenged, no matter what it is. And so whatever it is that you think you believe, if you're not holding the opposite view, I think you're actually in danger. Not because you don't need to be firm on what your convictions are, but just because you always need to be testing your thesis over and over and over again. That's why I like having these chats with you, because I get to kind of test wacky theories that I hear elsewhere against someone who is fairly straight, Yeah,
as traditional as they come. So the one challenge I'd bring you back on that one, right, is I would ask you the second question for me is about, well, what does all this mean for New Zealand? And so if we think about all of this global change and we think about all of these things that are happening offshore, how do we bring this into New Zealand, right? And I've written a bit about this in the past, and I'd love to kind of revisit this, but yeah, I do wonder what does it all mean for New Zealand, right? Is New Zealand another 50 years of just selling export raw commodities out of New Zealand? Do we actually need to go back to the future and start to think about building a manufacturing base again here in New Zealand? What are we doing? What is our growth strategy going to be? And do we look at what's happening in America? Do we look at what's happened in China where they're subsidized and they've built some stuff? I mean, yeah, I really kind of am curious as to what we do, right? Because I think, to your point, we do live in a different world. The world has evolved from where it has been for the last 25 years. But it feels as though in New Zealand, we're just trying to flog the same old shit. Do we actually need to do things a little bit differently?
I feel that on so many levels, what you're saying, because like I think when you're in business as well, right, it's the same thing. You have some successes and then you have some failures, and then you have these patches where you know you need to make some changes and pivot. That's when you look outside and go, well, what's actually happening around here? How can we adapt? So like, let's say New Zealand, traditionally raw materials, manufacturing, we basically supply stuff and we build the pipeline according to what the demand is. But then in times of immense change, it's like we have an identity crisis and we look to what other countries are doing and then get frustrated that we can't do it ourselves. For example, technology, there is a massive scene in New Zealand, especially in the blockchain world that I follow fairly closely, I think. And it strikes me as really, really peculiar that this goes probably right to the top in terms of regulation and all sorts of traditional structures from regulators, taxation, all that sort of stuff. This is the way we do things. This is the way we always have. It stunts growth. And in this new world, the players that truly want to innovate, they just go overseas instantly, so fast. Not physically, but electronically. They're gone and they're working overseas and their ideas go with them. And so to me, it kind of feels like the faster we recognize this, it's almost like a generational pattern that keeps on revisiting New Zealand's psyche. The faster we recognize that and snap out of it, the better it'll be. Because I think if the future is going to be more digital, shouldn't we be creating an ecosystem here in New Zealand where these startups can flourish, especially in the financial services space, I think, fast? Because everywhere else is going to do it and they're going to beat us by a country mile, unless we actually move quickly. But I don't think the people at the very top even understand what's going on in the technology space to react to it.
I 100% they don't understand. And I think we've seen that time and time out. I mean, my big challenge to that, and I do agree we need to basically figure out if that's what we want to do. We've got to create some regulatory settings and some environment that helps it, which we have not come close to doing at the moment. The second point, though, is, I mean, I'm a little bit of the view that actually, do we need to kind of, why are we going to win, right, in technology? Why are we going to win in blockchain? Why are we going to win? Like, let's answer the why and how we can win, right? Do we need to be kind of going back to doing a whole lot of other kind of simple things in the world, right? Do we need to get back into manufacturing? I mean, at the end of the day, logs is a really great example, right? Russia has created an amazing log and domestic processing industry because they simply said, you're no longer allowed to export raw logs out of Russia. You have to process them in country. And so what does that do? That's created thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs in wood processing. Why don't we do something like that here? And actually, at the end of the day, if we want to talk about environmental impact, it is far cheaper, easier, and environmentally friendly to be sending out finished product than it is to be sending out raw logs where half of it disappears as well. Milk powder. I mean, milk powder is kind of slightly harder because actually dried milk powder, once you've taken the water out of it, it potentially is. It's kind of the most efficient export form that you can get. But does that really help NZ Inc? I mean, when we talk about increasing dairy exports, effectively, at the moment, I think the only strategy for doing that is putting more cows on the ground, which I think most New Zealanders would argue is not the environmentally the thing that we want to see. So if we want to increase our exports, then what does that mean? It means we've got to go figure out a way to get up the value chain. How do we do that? We can either kind of, it's carrot or stick in my mind. Do we actually kind of put some limits as to how much they're allowed to export or what they're allowed to do? I don't really know what the answer is, but something's got to change, right? And if we want well-paid jobs here in New Zealand and a strong, stable domestic economy, I think we're going to have to bring some of that manufacturing.
Go up the value chain rather than just go horizontal and export primary or even secondary, go tertiary.
Right. And there's a great article someone wrote the other day. This is completely off topic, by the way, but great article someone wrote the other day. We're saying the current strategy seems to be, let's just kind of rip more out of our natural resources. So let's increase farm production. Let's start mining minerals. Let's kind of figure out what we can drag out of the ground, get those exports, and that's our growth strategy. We actually haven't seen anyone yet talk about how
that's
we start to add
I think that is a symptom, though, of we're a little bit confounded when we see times of immense change and we have an identity crisis. What do? We don't know who we are during these times. And I think that'll play out. Kiwi ingenuity will strike again. That's my hopeful belief anyway. There's two things that I want to raise with you before we finish up, because we're probably in overtime right now. The first thing is, and this is just something I just want to flag because I can kind of see that it may be a nothing burger at some stage, but I think it's quite significant, but I don't yet understand enough about it to know why it's significant. And I'm just being honest because I'm still learning. So we had First Republic Bank fail in the US. Was that probably just over a year ago? Yeah, March last year, right?
March last year.
And that led to a little bit more awareness of how, hey, when interest rates stay high, banks effectively become insolvent, and we have actually a systemic risk that could lead to a contagion. And that's somewhat concerning when we consider the participants in a financial system. Ironically, I think it was even just a few days ago, we had not First Republic fail, but Republic First fail. So we have a problem with branding, I guess, in the United States. Not a significant player like the other bank was, less significant, but what I understand about this is that there's now a precedent that's been set where the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, probably something like that, right? FDIC. Yeah, the insurance scheme, which effectively insures people's deposit up to a certain amount, it kind of doesn't really matter anymore, because increasingly what's happening is that these bailouts are just happening all the time, irrespective. And so what I wonder if that will usher in is a new period of, I guess, moral hazard, where banks will engage in more and more risky behavior in the future. Thoughts on that, Rupert?
Definitely. I mean, what we've seen over the last 18 months is the banks have been completely protected and insulated from duration risks. The duration risk is kind of where the valuation changes based on the length of the bonds that you've held. I think we've seen pretty quickly that the Fed don't really want to see anyone fail. And so, we have seen a few shotgun marriages as a result of that. And I would actually argue that moral hazard is getting lower and lower. I mean, what is pretty interesting, though, is last year was the highest number of bank failures in the US since 2009. And so, I mean, there was a lot, again, coming back to kind of where we started, which was the pointy end. The pointy end is looking really good. The pointy end is looking really profitable. But there's a hell of a lot of shit happening in below that that is going wrong. And I think, yeah, it was really interesting when we saw that last year. Bank failures than ever before. I think the truth, though, and this is, I think, and again, coming back to my learnings for the New Zealand banking sector, the US have kind of learned to deal with them. And the fact that they have 500 banks fail in a year, everyone goes, oh, who cares? It doesn't really matter. The deposit's protected. They know how to wind them up. They know how to deal with it. And I think in New Zealand, where our conversation is consistently, we'd much rather have banks that are far too profitable. And look what's going wrong in the US when you see all these bank failures. That's not a market we want to play in. I go, hold on a sec. That means that you've got communities accessing cheaper banking, getting better services because there's proper competition. And actually, bank failures aren't a real issue if you know how to deal with them. And so that would be my two cents right there. So higher moral hazard, but we also need to kind of get our heads around the fact that banks should fail, because if they're not failing, then they're probably too profitable.
Okay. All right. That's probably – okay. We'll have to stop it on that one because I have too many questions on that. Moving right along.
Yes, should we talk just quickly because of what happened?
Give me the lowdown. Yes, please, if you can, because I don't understand fully what this means. But to me, kind of going back to the start of the conversation, where is investing a pyramid scheme? Well, right at the base level here, we have one big driver of demand, which is the Japanese carry trade, where there's a lot of purchasing power on U.S. Treasuries come from a nation where it's simple to play a bit of an active arbitrage between those two places. So yeah, talk to me about what happened probably just overnight, really, right?
Yeah, so what we've seen over the last kind of probably 3 months, but particularly in the last kind of couple of weeks, is we've seen a significant weakening in the Japanese yen. It's gone historically traded in that kind of 120 to 140 range. And then over the last couple of days, it kind of breached the 160, which was previously thought of as unheard of, right? In previous worlds, and as you say, it's because in Japan you get paid zero or negative. Yeah. No, they're above zero now in their interest rates. And so investors can go and say, well, I can invest here in Japan and get paid nothing, or I can put all my money in US Treasury bonds and get paid 4 or 5%. Mm. I know which I'd do. And so what we've seen, a bit of capital flight out of Japan as a result of that. That's got worse over the last week or two. As the kind of the pivot upon the pivot with the Fed, where all of a sudden interest rates are looking as though they're going to get higher. Japan interest rates are kind of going to likely to stay where they are. US interest rates getting higher. So the investors are going, fuck, I'm way better off kind of moving my money out. What we saw overnight is actually the Ministry of Finance in Japan have gone, enough's enough. We're proud of our currency. We import way too much stuff, and so therefore we need to protect it. And so we saw for the first time, we suspect, it hasn't been confirmed yet, but we saw currency intervention. And that's what this means, is this means that the Japanese Ministry of Finance have gone out and they have bought a whole lot of Japanese yen, selling the US dollar to try and tell them, kind of really trying to bully the markets and go, hold on a sec. We've got the biggest balance sheet of everyone, and we're going to do everything we can to protect this. And look, over time, historically, we have seen a fair amount of this happen through different economies. It happened in 2010 with the Swiss franc against the euro. Most kind of well-known approach to this has been around when George Soros attacked the pound to push it out of the eurozone mechanics. So look, these things do happen. They very, very, very rarely work, in that the markets kind of are happy and kind of sustain a lot longer than central banks or Ministry of Finances do. But it is really interesting, right? So because I think we are about to start to see some currency wars play out. It's not just kind of with the strength of the US dollar. That's going to be something that will be kind of talked about a lot in my mind as we start approaching this election cycle. Because a very strong US dollar means that imports from all of these countries, so imports from Japan, from China, from Europe, all of a sudden become really cheap and exports get hard. And as a country that's kind of refocusing itself on manufacturing and becoming a manufacturing hub for the world, that is going to get kind of a lot worse, right? So we've seen it overnight in Japan. look, I think we're about to start. We might start to see something happening in China when they start intervening in the currency markets there. And saying that, for them, a lower currency is by far and the way the best. The question is, what does the US do about that? Because a low currency is just another subsidy on exports. And at the moment, we know that a massive gripe for the US government is just how much subsidy is already going to some of these
exports. Well stated. And then the reason why, maybe they want to keep the market on edge. Maybe it's about buying their energy, right? So maybe that's why they intervened, or just to show that they could. I don't know. Time will tell, right? But when you see currency wars, it's just another manifestation, I think, of global conflict, right?
It's just another tension. Okay. Yeah,
covered a lot of ground. Earnings updates. What does stagflation look like in terms of investing? How impossible it is to pick a market. Japanese yen situation, and the other one. What was the other one that we talked about? Oh yeah, banking crises. Yeah, so there's not like there's
nothing going on. Do you know what the best part about today, Darcy, is? None of that covered anywhere close to what I thought we were going to talk about.
Well, maybe we could just reuse the template of discussion points next week. How about we try that? But we'll probably throw it all away.
Exactly. Anyway.
That's cool. All right. Well, hey, now anybody awesome. Listening who likes this style of banter and likes to hear Rupert, cover these somewhat complex topics with a certain degree of clarity, please do share these episodes with your friends. It's really hard to find New Zealand-based content that covers international events, I think, with a New Zealand lens, as amateurly as we possibly can. So please do share this. Help us to get better. Look forward to catching up with you next week.
And let us know any questions or anything else you want us to cover. We want to cover what you want to hear versus only not just what we want
to talk about. Awesome. Well said. All right, Rupert, we'll catch you next week.